Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 539, titled Beneath the Covers. This is being recorded on January 29th of the year 2006. This is the first originally recorded program of the new year, 2006, obviously. So let me first of all wish all of you out there a happy new year and a productive new year. Let me also begin this year by charging the people who listen to the program and who value the material with a task. Some of you are already doing a very good job with this task, and what I'd like to do is to encourage all of you to do what you reasonably can to further that task. That task is getting the word out. That task is using the growing and already enormous amount of material on the Spitfire website, both audio material and printed material, and the material on the linked websites, both audio and printed, and disseminate the information via the internet, blogs, talk shows, chat groups, whatever mediated communication is available to you. I want to really, really strongly encourage members of the listening audience to take advantage of the communications that are available to us, the internet, talk shows, and such, some the various technologies of that type, and use the information on the website. Now, as regular listeners are probably aware, I have taken a short hiatus from original production. That is because I have been engaged in a writing project. We now have a number of wonderful old anti-fascist books, books that are now more than 50 years old, and they are up and available on the Spitfire website, and they are available for free. This is a remarkable, well, it's really something of a library in and of itself. I began to realize I realized as I was sort of plunging forward through the research that I've been doing on September 11th and related subject material, that to a significant percentage of the audience, a lot of the things that I was talking about, in particular my discussion of a fifth column in the United States that aided the attacks, this might not mean a great deal to members of the audience, and that's in no way a finding of fault. I've been described in many ways by many people, but I describe myself as an anti-fascist. I've undertaken, it became clear to me early on in my adult life that some things were going dreadfully wrong. That perception began really in a fundamental way with my study of the assassination of President Kennedy. I've done what I could over the years to use media, both printed and audio, to communicate as much vital information to the audience as I could. Over the years of the September 11th investigations, I began to realize that an awful lot of what I was talking about probably did not make a lot of sense to people, simply because the methodology and substantive history of fascism was really not something that most people had achieved a familiarity with. So, in order to help bridge that gap, we have put a number of remarkable books. A listener back east boiled these books down into some really compact Adobe PDF files. They are easily downloaded. You can download them to your computer very quickly, and then print them up, have them bound in a cheap binding, and you got the books. What I've been doing for the last month or so is polishing off a project that I didn't think was going to take this much time, but then any time Dave Emery sits down to begin producing words, whether orally or in print, things tend to sort of snowball and roll downhill. So not surprisingly, the project turned out to be considerably longer than I had anticipated. I've written a fairly good-sized introduction and overview of the various books that are available on the Spitfire website, and also three that are going to be available but are not available yet. I've also written introductions to each of the books that is already up there. And what I'm going to do in this program is to read some of what I have been concentrating on. From this point forward, I will be producing new programs each week, or almost each week. There may be some times when I take a break for other professional reasons, but I thought that by way of easing into the new year and by way of also providing some emphatic encouragement to members of the audience to use the material available on the Spitfire website and related websites to get the word out. And what I'm going to do, this is sort of an experimental format for a program, but what I'm going to do are read not only the introduction to the books, but some of the introductions, some of the summaries and reviews of the various books. And by way of launching a new year, by way of christening, so to speak, an effort on the part of the audience to do as much as possible, not just this year, but every year, to get the word out, I thought we'd take a look at the past, and through coming to understand the past, understand the present better, and through coming to understand the present better, hopefully we will be able to deal with the future in a more effective fashion. We're going to begin. I'm going to read the introduction to the books in its entirety. And again, if you just tuned in, if you're a regular listener, the reason I haven't been producing new shows, and I will be doing that from this point forward, I've been engaged in a writing project, not only writing an introduction to the old anti-fascist books now available for free on the Spitfire website, but a description and review of each book. The general introduction begins with a joke that made the rounds in the early 1980s. If there are listeners out there who are saying, oh, there goes Dave again, with that old stuff, it's old, it doesn't matter anymore. Well, William Faulkner observed, the past is never dead and buried, it isn't even past. The introduction begins with a joke that made the rounds in the early 1980s. It's a good thing we didn't lose World War II. If we had, all our public officials would be named Schultz, Weinberger, and Kissinger, and everybody be driving Japanese and German cars. Of course, we're all very glad that didn't happen, right? Schultz, Weinberger, and Kissinger, of course, a reference to George Schultz, Cap Weinberger, and Henry Kissinger, who were major political luminaries in the Nixon, Ford, and Reagan administrations. Now, for younger listeners, those names might not be as clear and significant as they were for the older listeners. The main body of the introduction itself reads, in the decades since the end of the Second World War, much has been written about the war and fascism, the driving force behind the aggression that precipitated that conflict. Unfortunately, much of what has been said and written has failed to identify and analyze the causes, nature, and methodology of fascism, German National Socialism, or Nazism in particular. A deeper, more accurate analysis was presented in literature published before, during, and immediately after World War II. The Spitfire website is pleased to present a number of books published during that period. All more than 50 years old, these works embody a more complete, profound analysis of the historical forces that dominated the events of that time and, more importantly, our own. Whereas much contemporary literature on the subject presents fascism and Nazism in particular as an aberration, the phenomenon was an outgrowth of major political forces and dynamics that dominate and control contemporary events and processes. Some of the books presented here illustrate the extent to which fascism, Nazism in particular, was an outgrowth of globalization and the construction of international monopolies or cartels. For the record shows 99, 361, 426, 511, and 532 present an overview of the reinvestment of the wealth generated by the American industrial boom of the 1920s in Japanese and German strategic heavy industry. It was this capital that drove the engines of conquest that subdued both Europe and Asia during the conflict. Germany's Master Plan, 1943, by Borken and Welch, analyzes how the Nazis took advantage of the budding globalized economy to restrict their enemies' strategic production as well as their access to critical raw materials. Treason's Peace, 1947, by Howard Watson Ombruster, highlights how the IG Farben chemical firm manipulated trade relationships to the advantage of the Third Reich. In addition, The book illustrates how corporations, businessmen, and politicians beholden under the firm's non-German cartel partners assisted that manipulation, as well as the post-war rehabilitation and exoneration of both IG and its most important personnel. Those personnel and the vast reach of IG Farben and its cartel partners are also the subject of Josiah Du Bois's The Devil's Chemists. James Stewart Martin's All Honorable Men of 1950, by the way, I neglected to put in here that The Devil's Chemist is from 1952. James Stewart Martin's All Honorable Men documents the manner in which powerful economic interests in the United States frustrated attempts at decartelization and thereby ensured the post-war perpetuation of globalized business as usual, unquote. As Martin points out, these commercial interests were able to successfully manipulate the networks through which government operates and direct it to their own nefarious ends. The lone title in the collection, Less Than 50 Years Old, Paul Manning's Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile from 1981, chronicles the post-war underground perpetuation of the Nazi political and business hierarchy and its dominant role in both the international corporate economy and the contemporary political landscape. The Third Reich's elaborate plans for post-war underground survival and continuity were predicated on the certainty that the multinational corporate community would preserve the Nazi infrastructure as a bulwark against communism during the then-imminent Cold War. The Underground Reich was foreseen and analyzed in Kurt Riess's The Nazis Go Underground, published in early 1944. In addition to the powerful corporate economic interests allied with Nazi business centers, the process of underground perpetuation was greatly aided by the Fifth Column movements abroad. Composed of ideological supporters of the fascist philosophy, these Fifth Column movements were instrumental in realizing Nazi blueprints for military conquest during the war, as well as post-war continuation and enlargement of those plans. Written on the eve of World War II, Joseph Gollum's Army of Spies correctly anticipated the enormous scope and effectively successful activities of the Fifth Columnists in nations slated for Nazi invasion. Triumph of Treason, 1944, by Pierre Coe, is a remarkable first-hand account of the subversion of France by powerful domestic interests who saw political control by their ideological allies and cartel business partners in Germany as preferable to power sharing with their own democratically minded citizens. Coe had been the French Minister of Aviation in the immediate pre-war period and witnessed the deliberate success of the domination of several continents, Europe, North Africa, and Latin America. The Nazis and their allies in the General Staff groomed the Spanish Falange as the fascist movement of choice. Writing of this in 1943, Alan Chase notes how the Reich then used political control of Spain to advance their agenda in Latin America and the Spanish-speaking world. The reader is invited to address Chase's research in light of the relatively well-documented post-war operation and perpetuation of fascist interests in Latin America. For the Nazis, geopolitics dictated a profound interest in the Muslim peoples of what they called the Earth Island, a giant, contiguous landmass that encompasses all of Europe, much of the Middle East, then the former Soviet Union, India, including Pakistan at the time, and China. Stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar to the Pacific coasts of China and Russia, this landmass contains most of the world's territory, population, and natural resources, oil in particular. Control that land, and you control the world. Accordingly, the Nazis built alliances with the various Muslim populations, Arabs in particular, that are indigenous to many of the most important petroleum-producing regions. Writing in 1951, John Roy Carlson witnessed and chronicled the post-war Nazi recrudescence in the Middle East in Cairo to Damascus, a work that has particular importance for students of the events of 9/11/2001. In an earlier work, Undercover from 1943, Carlson infiltrated and wrote about the vigorous Axis underground that existed in the United States before and during Albert E. Kahn penned Sabotage in 1940. This nature of many of the American Fifth Columnists who committed acts of assassination and sabotage in support of the Axis powers. These tactics were used to good effect in Germany and Japan, where potential political opponents to the rise of fascism were eliminated through a deliberate program of political murder. It is in that context that we may view Government by Assassination from 1942, Hugh Bias's riveting account of the assassinations committed by the Japanese Patriotic and Ultranationalist Societies. Culminating in the May 15th incident, the assassination of the Japanese Prime Minister on May 15, 1932, these murders were instrumental in the accession to power of the Japanese militarists and the corporate and imperial elements behind them. Two other books available here provide valuable insights into the contemporary period. T.H. Tetten's Germany Plots with the Kremlin from 1953 treats the pivotally important German Ostpolitik, which German power structure has traditionally exploited in order to expand and develop its influence. The German threat to either remain neutral during the Cold War or to ally with the USSR was a significant factor in persuading conservative American power brokers to go along with the return to power in Germany of the very Nazi elements that prosecuted World War II. Under the circumstances, some of these conservatives felt that permitting Nazi elements to return to power behind a democratic facade was the lesser of two evils, although many would have preferred a more traditionally conservative German political establishment. This German Ostpolitik, in turn, is characteristic of the geopolitical foresight and cynicism with which pan-Germanists have successfully pursued their goal of world domination through the centuries. Paul Winkler's The Thousand-Year Conspiracy from 1943 traces the origins of German chauvinism to the ascent of the Teutonic Knights within Germanic society. Winkler labels the enablers of the dark side of the German character Prusso-Teutonics, unquote, and notes that, in their pursuit of pan-German goals, they do not hesitate to deal in a cynical and ruthless manner with their own citizens. Of particular note for contemporary Americans is the deliberate Machiavellian manipulation of the German economy by Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, the American-born financier who eventually became the finance minister of the Third Reich. Take note of Winkler's account of how Schacht restructured the German economy with an eye to, among other things, driving the citizenry to such a point of hysteria that they would willingly follow the likes of Hitler. Compare Winkler's analysis with what is taking place today in the United States. Writing in 1943, Winkler foresaw that the Prusso-Teutonics would realize their goals through the creation of a German-dominated Central European Economic Union bearing a striking resemblance to today's European Monetary Union. And that introduction closes with a couple of quotes. One is a famous quote, "Those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it," by philosopher George Santayana, and also a quote from the introduction to Borken and Welsh's Germany's Master Plan, The Story of an Industrial Offensive. That book, by the way, published in 1943. Joseph Borken was also the author of the 1979 book, The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. In the introduction to Germany's Master Plan from 1943, then U.S. Attorney General Thurman W. Arnold wrote, quote, "We cannot turn over our future economic policy to private groups without public responsibility as we have in the past," unquote. Ha! Boy, doesn't that look strange and bitterly ironic in light of everything that's happened since, privatization being the order of the day. Now, again, these books are an invaluable research source, and I'm going to read some or all of some of the book introductions by way of not only providing the audio listening audience with some initial familiarity with these volumes, but also to underscore some points that perhaps could stand with some underscoring in connection in particular with my analysis of contemporary events, the events in and around September 11th in particular. From the description that I wrote about Germany's Master Plan, The Story of an Industrial Offensive by Joseph Borken and Charles A. Welch from 1943, we read, "Germany's Master Plan, 1943, by Borken and Welch, analyzes how the Nazis took advantage of the budding globalized economy to restrict both their enemies' strategic production and their access to critical raw materials. The same cartel agreements gave the German war economy access to technological know-how and raw materials vital to the successful prosecution of modern defeat from World War I. The German military-industrial complex also sought to use technological innovation to make up for key areas of shortfall. Utilizing leading-edge technology to great advantage, companies such as IG Farben developed processes to synthesize oil, rubber, narcotics to treat casualties, and other innovations that greatly aided the German wartime economy. I can appreciate that for many listeners, when I talk about the Underground Reich, that just must sound particularly crazy. Well, remember that the Mafia began as a resistance movement in 12th and 13th century Sicily to Norse and Saracen invaders, basically Vikings and Turks. Well, the Vikings and the Turks are long gone from Sicily. The 12th and 13th centuries a long time ago, but the Mafia is still very much present in Sicily, and it's not just present there, it's present in the United States as well. Every Sunday night about 9 o'clock, a nice segment of the American television viewing audience tunes into a melodrama, The Sopranos, about an organization that's very real, very present in the United States, but that began in the 12th and 13th century in Sicily as a resistance movement to Viking and Saracen invaders. The point is, underground political movements can be perpetuated. Another thing to understand, in addition to the cartels, which had much to do with preserving the economic power that powered the Reich, one must also understand the philosophy of Karl von Clausewitz, the Prussian military philosopher. If listeners use the search function on the Spitfire website there, the von Clausewitz is mentioned in a number of programs. But in this introduction to Germany's master plan from 1943, an understanding of the philosophy of Karl von Clausewitz is key, and it's set forth here in the description. Reading. Key to the German industrial offensive was the doctrine of the famous Prussian military philosopher Karl von Clausewitz, the first strategic thinker to formalize the concept of total war. On pages 16 and 17, Borken and Welch discuss von Clausewitz's analysis of the relationship between war and peace, essential to understanding the concept of total war. Quote, Germany has long understood this strategy of total war. Karl von Clausewitz, the father of modern German militarism, set out its major premises when he said, quote, War is no independent thing. The main lineaments of all great strategic plans are of a political nature, the more so the more they include the totality of war in the state, unquote. To von Clausewitz, peace was a continuation of war by other means. In effect, he said to Germany, quote, Disarm your enemy in peace by diplomacy and trade if you would conquer him more readily on the field of battle, unquote. This philosophy of war and peace became the keynote of Germany's political and economic intercourse with other nations. These tenets explain why, twice within a generation, we have entered war not only facing the might of German armies, but shackled by economic bondage to German industry. German-controlled cartels were at all times the servants of German interest. That their loyalty to Germany was undivided explains the uniformity of the agreements which they made. Germany's industrial attack had as its cardinal purpose the reversal of blockade. Patents and secret know-how were used to bar our access to our own technology. By contrast, and this is me writing here, by contrast, the German firm's foreign cartel partners looked on these relationships as mere vehicles to maximize profits by eliminating competition and limiting production. On page 17, the authors develop this theme. Quote, To businessmen in the United States, England, and France, international cartels were an efficient means of guaranteeing monopoly. Industrialists outside of Germany thought in terms of low output, high prices, and maximum profits. They regarded divisions of both territory and the fields of production as comfortable and easily policed methods by which they could free themselves from competition and create spheres of monopoly, unquote. In the second half of the program, we're going to read some of the description from the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, about which we've spoken so many times in the past. I would note that as Manning wrote in that book, the German core corporations, not all German corporations, but the German core corporations are run by this underground Reich. And one of the significant difference in a globalized marketplace, globalization was well underway in the early part of the 20th century. It was one of the things that created the economic power that the Nazis and the Japanese used to conquer Europe and Asia, respectively. Globalization has continued, but whereas American corporations continue to basically be apatriotic, to coin a term, they will readily sell out to a foreign competitor and sell out the country's interests in so doing, the German corporations function like the units of an army. use the Spitfire website and look up Vodaphone, V-O-D-A-P-H-O-N-E, V-O-D-A-P-H-O-N-E, and Monesmon, M-A-N-N-E-S-M-A-N-N. That is the only hostile takeover of a major German corporation in history. Monesmon is one of the the German core corporations. Originally a heavy industrial firm, it branched out into telecommunications. When the British-owned Vodafone tried to basically effect a hostile takeover of Monesmon, the other major German corporations and banks rallied around rather like a school of porpoises or dolphins rallying around a stricken member of their herd or pod. That's very different from the way American corporations behave. Just take a look, for example, at the old Chrysler Corporation. Now it's Daimler Chrysler. And there's a joke. How do you pronounce Daimler Chrysler in German? Daimler. The Chrysler is silent. That firm, by the way, was in deep trouble in 1980. It was bailed out with a huge U.S. taxpayer subsidy. But nonetheless, when the time came, it was readily gobbled up. That is in sharp contrast with the way the German corporations behave. And we're going to continue with our look at the past by way of shoring up our understanding of the present. And in particular, we're going to take a look at fifth column movements and how they're used, because I think in understanding the Muslim Brotherhood's infiltration of the United States, in understanding the SAR network, the Safa Trust, Bank al-Taqwa, and many of the things that lie at the foundation of our inquiry into September 11th, I think an understanding of fascist fifth column methodology is important. And we're going to continue with all of this inside, too. Please, again, do everything you can to distribute information from the Spitfire website and related websites. There's a wealth of it. It's growing. In addition to the books and the introductions that I've written, there's a link to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU featuring the entire For the Record broadcast for download for free on Real Audio and MP3. WFMU is also podcasting the For the Record programs. Listeners in the Midwest have put together a website with the declassified government documents proving the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II, subject we're going to touch on inside, too. There's a search function on the Spitfire website. There are lectures available for download. There are the more recent For the Record shows on the Spitfire website as well. Long article-length descriptions of the various programs that I've done. So please take advantage of the Spitfire website. It is an enormous resource. Oh, by the way, and last but certainly not least, there is a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if you value this information, there's no better way of supporting what I'm of getting the word out than supporting what I'm doing. But please, as we move into the new year, as we begin again, let's do what we can to utilize this website, get the information out, and basically maintain a steady pace of cranking it out there. Don't be discouraged if people don't respond right away, or if you don't ever get a tangible response. That doesn't mean you're not being effective. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program 539, Beneath the Covers, by the way, a reference, Teehee, to the books that were now up on the Spitfire website, because there's a lot of good stuff beneath the covers of those books. My name is Dave Emery. This has been recorded on January 29th of 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Happy New Year, and thanks for listening.